It is Tuesday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabwe's Parliament Speaker says President Robert Mugabe has resigned. The United States launches new airstrikes against Islamic State in Libya. And we learn how birds connect people to nature. It's all ahead. Speaker of Zimbabwe's parliament says Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe has resigned. Speaker Jacob Mudenda read out what he said was a letter from Mugabe, which read, "I, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, in terms of Section 96 of the Constitution of Zimbabwe, hereby formally tender my resignation with immediate effect." I'm joined on the line by VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell in Johannesburg, South Africa. Anita, why does this occur now? Why didn't Mugabe fold immediately when the tanks rolled in?
Right. So you just cited the letter that Mugabe apparently wrote, in which he cites Section 96 of the Constitution, and that's kind of the key to this. Mugabe is a stickler for rules, and Section 96 of the Constitution says that the president's resignation has to be delivered by the Speaker of Parliament in a letter. So he did it exactly by the book.
Okay. Now, has this been confirmed?
Right, so we haven't received independent confirmation, but the Speaker did read it in front of a full seating of both houses of Parliament. So no, at this time, we haven't heard anything from Mugabe's people, from the presidency, that I know of at least, but I think it's probably gone over the brink. I don't think he can go back now. The people of Zimbabwe have accepted this as fact.
What will happen now?
So the head of the ZANU-PF party, the party leader, has said that the deposed vice president, the vice president of Mugabe fired, Emmerson Mnangagwa, will likely return. The parliament speaker said that they will have a new leader in place probably by the end of the day tomorrow. That's Wednesday. So we will have an interim government. It's unclear how long they're going to be in place or anything like that, but the leadership there will continue.
Who is Emmerson Mnangagwa?
Emmerson Mnangagwa has a great nickname. He's called the Crocodile, and that's because he was a key figure in Zimbabwe's liberation war in the 70s, and he went on to become a staunch ally of Robert Mugabe. Many considered him his right-hand man. And yet Robert Mugabe fired him a few weeks ago, which was maybe the breaking point for many Zimbabweans, because it was believed that Mugabe was going to replace Mnangagwa with his wife, Grace Mugabe. So Mnangagwa was kind of the guy who's been at the center of this entire drama, and he is presumably the next president of Zimbabwe.
What is next for Robert and Grace Mugabe?
That is the big question. And right now, it's not clear where they're going to go or even if they are going to go anywhere, but it seems like a fair guess that they might go somewhere. They own property in Malaysia and in Singapore, so those are possibilities, I suppose. Also a possibility of South Africa, but there's one problem with that. In August, Grace Mugabe was accused of assaulting a model who was spending time with her adult sons who live here in Johannesburg. And prosecutors have said if she returns to South Africa, she may face criminal charges. She got out of it through diplomatic immunity, but if she returns to South Africa, she might be in trouble. So that makes South Africa a difficult choice for the Mugabe family.
So was this a coup?
That's a great question. So from the beginning, the military stressed that this was not a coup, that this was not a military takeover. And in one way, they're right. It looks like we're going to see a restoration of civilian rule. And the Military Veterans Association rather charmingly called this a bloodless correction. And they, too, were right, because it doesn't look like there was major bloodshed, major property damage, anything like that. So this is a uniquely Zimbabwean situation, and it's quite lovely in that way. It's some people are still calling it a coup. Maybe it was. But at the end of the day, nobody appears to have been hurt. Property does not appear to have been damaged. And the president resigned, apparently voluntarily. would you call that a coup? I don't know. What we would call it is just a momentous day for Zimbabwe.
Yeah. Well, is this a new beginning for Zimbabwe? Will things turn around for the country now?
Well, Emmerson Mnangagwa says he's going to embark on a project of reforms. He says he's going to be inclusive. He released a statement today. Nobody knows exactly where he is, by the way, because he has left Zimbabwe, he said, for his own safety. But anyway, he has a lot on his plate. The economy is in tatters. The health system, the education system, infrastructure are just completely degraded. Some would say as a result of mismanagement under the Mugabe regime. So changing the guy at the top is a really, it's a shot to the arm for many Zimbabweans who are celebrating right now. But I'm not sure it would, Zimbabwe has a lot of problems, and it's going to be a tough road ahead for Zimbabwe.
And what has the reaction been like in Zimbabwe, in Harare?
So I've been hearing snippets from, you know, my colleagues in Harare, from some of our VOA people in Harare. When I was talking earlier to our reporter in Harare, I could hardly hear him. The cheering was so loud. Another reporter said that she couldn't get anywhere in a taxi because the driver kept stopping to hug people. Another said that her waiter was crying. So it's high emotion in Harare on the streets. People are dancing and singing. And we're also seeing some of that here in Johannesburg, where there's a large Zimbabwean community, many of whom fled here in 2008 after troubled elections in Zimbabwe.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Anita. That's VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell in Johannesburg, South Africa. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure this is getting a lot of reaction on social media.
Absolutely. And a lot of what Anita talked about, we're seeing play out on social media. The text of Robert Mugabe's letter quickly circulating as people pick out specific lines, one in particular where the now former president says he was leaving the office voluntarily. That was something that was getting a lot of jokes made at the expense of that line. And as Anita mentioned, the scenes in the streets of the capital, Harare, people had been protesting. We'd seen a lot of those protests and rallies on social media, but now we're beginning to see those scenes of celebration as people are sharing photos and videos. It really is taking the whole world into Zimbabwe to mark this momentous shift. Here in the U.S., we're marking the continuation of the allegations of sexual harassment and assault by high-profile figures with two new names that have been added. John Conyers, a congressman from Michigan who's the longest-serving member of the U.S. House of Representatives, reportedly settling some sexual assault and harassment suits with women over the years. There have been calls now for his resignation, continued calls for addressing the deep-rooted systemic problems with sexual assault and harassment in the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate. This is one of the kind of offshoots of the story that people have been talking about on social media, that is actually very difficult to report these instances among staffers there. And the other person we're talking about today on social media, prominent journalist Charlie Rose, accused by nearly 10 women of sexual misconduct, one of the hosts of the CBS This Morning program in the U.S., his two co-hosts, Gail King and O'Donnell, journalists, receiving praise on social media for how they handled the show this morning. They said that even though he's their friend and colleague, he does not get a pass on these allegations. And one thing that journalist Gail King says that a lot of people are saying they agree with, she says she's trying to come to terms with how someone she knew and respected and cared for could do such terrible things. And I think that speaks to the sentiment a lot of people are expressing on social media as they see these figures that were revered or loved, whether they're actors or politicians or what have you. Suddenly it's revealed that they've engaged in this behavior, and it really is something difficult for people to deal with.
Yeah, very much so. All right, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin have been talking about the Syrian peace process. Pakistan welcomes a U.S. offer to prevent militant raids from Afghanistan. A U.S. judge blocks President Trump's order on sanctuary cities, and the U.S. government unveils its global water strategy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. When you think of Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun, you probably don't think of it as having any ice. But research over the last 30 years has suggested that ice might be found inside the planet's craters, where it's shielded from the rays of the Sun. In a new study, researchers from Brown University found three craters near the planet's north pole that seem to hold large accumulations of surface ice. Along with these larger deposits, the Brown researchers say they have also found evidence of smaller collections of ice hidden not only inside craters, but also in shadowed terrain between craters. The researchers say that while these additional deposits might be small individually, together they could add up to a lot more ice on Mercury that had not been accounted for. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll learn about the joy of investigating backyard birds. Officials tell VOA that the U.S. military has launched new airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Libya. I'm joined now by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what are officials saying about these airstrikes?
Thanks, Sarah, for having me on. The Africa Command is saying that there were two strikes, one on November the 17th and one on the 19th, near a town that's in the center of the country of Libya, not on the coast, which is where we're used to seeing these strikes. We are hearing that several militants were killed. We don't have an exact number yet, but these were the first strikes that we've seen in Libya since September. It's been relatively quiet in that country. As of last year, there were about 500 airstrikes there that were pushing Islamic State fighters out of Sirte. That was a coastal town where, or coastal city, I should say, where they were trying to establish a new hub as the caliphate, the so-called caliphate, was falling in Iraq and in Syria. But so far, the U.S. had appeared to be focused more on the fight against militants in Somalia, and they're still focused on that, I should add. There was new information just coming out today on that. But the big push here in Libya is to just establish that the United States is there to support the Libyan government, and it's not going to allow Islamic State to get a foothold, even if they try hiding for a while. Whenever the U.S. sees an opportunity to strike them, they will.
Yeah, so this is really occurring now because Islamic State is weakened, is lost, is losing in Iraq and Syria.
That is what the experts say, because the major areas of Islamic State, Mosul, that has fallen in Iraq, Raqqa, the de facto capital, has fallen in Syria, and now it is just little tiny pockets in the southeast in Syria and just in the west in Iraq that are left. And so the Islamic State has been looking for other areas to go to because they have realized that they are defeated in that area. One of those places was Libya, but the United States had a huge campaign last year and is continuing to do that to prevent them from having that establishment there. And they've also been trying in areas like Somalia. Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda affiliate there, is a very strong presence, and it's a very it's not a very safe place to be right now. Let's just put it that way, Sarah. And so Islamic State has tried to take advantage of that discord with the Somali government as well. And the United States conducted the first strikes against Islamic State there. And then just today, I'm learning within minutes of your show, the U.S. Africa Command struck more al-Shabaab targets. This time, it was a training camp near Mogadishu, and more than 100 militants were killed. So it's clear to see that the United States is actually trying to go in different places in Africa to try to prevent any militants from getting a stronghold there.
Yes, because certainly in the past, as years ago in Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda got a strong foothold in, there have been concerns about Libya and Somalia, particularly in Libya, because after the ouster and eventual death of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, it's ripe for terrorism, unfortunately.
Yes, this is something that the United States has realized. They know ever since September 11th, 2001, the United States has realized that global terrorism is, in fact, global. You cannot just let a pocket sit in some remote area of some remote country, because even those can reach the United States. And if they can't get inside the United States to conduct an attack, they can go after U.S. citizens in other countries. They can try via cyber to try to manipulate and influence others to conduct attacks. So it's a very difficult process, and it's one that the United States military is definitely spread out on, but they are trying their best, as we see with the strike today in Somalia and the ones over the weekend in Libya. It is something they are trying to stay on top of.
Yeah, and just one last thing, Carla. I know this was also just breaking that apparently a joint U.S.-Africa Command military team discovered additional human remains at the site where Sergeant La David Johnson's body was found. This is in Niger. He was involved in that operation. What has the Pentagon been saying about that so far?
That is right. The Pentagon just did confirm that. They had found remains earlier, but they had sent a crew to Niger to investigate what happened in this October 4th attack. Four U.S. service members were killed in this, four Nigerian service members, and a translator. All of those were killed in this surprise attack that no one really expected to happen in Niger. And they did confirm today, they have notified the family that additional remains of La David Johnson were found by this investigative team. They have gone through and confirmed with DNA that that is, in fact, him. They still do not know exactly what happened in this situation, Sarah. They are conducting an investigation now on the African continent, the European continent, and in the United States to try to figure out and piece together from everybody who was involved in Sergeant Johnson's team, in other teams in the area, to find out why they were in such a position, because clearly, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has said, it appears that maybe something had changed with why they were there and why they were there so long. And we just really want to find out what happened, because four U.S. service members were killed. And, you know, all these weeks later, we still don't know what happened. But they are hoping to complete that investigation by January and finally tell us what went wrong.
All right. Thanks very much, Carla. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Millions of Americans feed wild birds flying over their backyards, from cardinals and English sparrows to blue jays and doves. Making seeds available attracts more birds and gives feeders a chance to enjoy watching and maybe counting them. But it also helps birds, whether they're native or just passing through, survive amid the growing urban sprawl. Faiza El-Masri has the story, which Faith Lapidus narrates.
Sumner Askin started feeding birds just a few years ago when he was in college majoring in wildlife science.
I had just taken this class, ornithology, the study of birds, and I was just super into it. And I got one feeder and I put it all the way up in this tree. I probably climbed like 30 feet so I could hang it right outside my window. And I got some cool stuff and I just wanted to keep going with it to see what else I could get.
He got lots of birds. Downy woodpeckers, northern cardinals, mourning doves, house sparrows, hummingbirds, and many others. And watching them was a learning experience.
You learn just how each species is designed differently, like the way their toes are shaped so they can grip things differently and climb. You see the individuality of each of them. Like the little invasive species around here, like the house sparrow and the European starling, just have a little disdain for them, you know, so they chase around the other guys. Some people don't like the big blue jays because they're loud, but I like them a lot. They're just big.
Askin uses a variety of feeders to make it more adventurous for the birds.
Most birds, like a small sparrow, can't exactly stand on the side of a tree like a woodpecker can, you know, because it gets its toes in there and it just climbs up. The low-hanging finch feeder over there, a normal feeder, they sit on it and they turn sideways and they eat. But that one, they have to hang upside down. So you watch them just pivot completely upside down, and only two species can do that. So it's just for them instead of the non-native sparrows.
Askin spends about $100 a month buying bird seed. He shops at Wild Birds Unlimited, a store that sells seeds and feeders and where he has a part-time job. Wild Birds Unlimited owner Michael Zeiker has run the business for 26 years. He says some 53 million Americans enjoy the hobby.
Well, gardening's the first, backyard bird feeding second, and they pretty much blend into each other. We spend a lot of time, too, also with the schools, because a lot of school teachers have programs, and they've set up habitats in their schools to teach the young kids about the birds, the species, the nesting, and how to attract them.
Zeiker says people like to feed and watch wild birds for many reasons.
I think one of the most important reasons is it's a very, very peaceful, emotional experience. You put the food out there, you spend time on your deck in the nice weather, in the winter you're indoors watching the birds, and you never know what's going to show up. Most of the yards around here can easily get 30 different species of birds in their backyard.
Paul Starzynski agrees. He picked up the hobby after retiring 3 years ago.
And if you sit quietly, they come real close, and you don't bother them, and you can watch them. You can even see the little seed in their beak before they swallow it. It's kind of fun. Besides, I like them fly over my head, and I would be alone out there if I didn't have the birds.
Other birders take the hobby to another level.
My neighbor, who's a real birder, he knows everything. I don't. He found 13 species over by lunch in the backyard. Now, some of them just look all the same to me, but he knows the difference between that one and that one.
Even without knowing the bird species or where they come from, Paul Starzynski loves his new hobby. He's just one of millions of Americans who enjoy the colorful beauty and songs the feathered visitors bring to their backyards. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For too long, Somalis have suffered an unceasing campaign of terrorist violence. Since the beginning of the year, terrorists have perpetrated over 40 attacks of terrorism using armed suicide assaults, truck bombs, and remotely detonated improvised explosive devices in Mogadishu alone. And then, in mid-October, the most devastating attack in Somali history took place. On October 14th, the streets of Mogadishu's Hodan district were jam-packed with traffic and bystanders when a truck loaded with explosives detonated, killing at least 400 people and wounding hundreds of others. Shortly thereafter, a second, smaller explosion, believed to have been part of a coordinated plot with the first attack, took place across town. "The attack was our 9/11, said General Bashir Abdi Mohammed, the deputy commissioner of the Somali police force. No Somali was untouched. The Somali public, outraged by the brazen attack on innocent civilians, have voiced their demand for peace and justice in their country. One element working to turn the tide in Somalia's fight against terrorism is its joint investigative teams, elite Somali police force units that investigate terrorist attacks and gather evidence to identify the perpetrators and prosecute them. Set up with the help of the U.S. Department of State in 2014, they have responded to over 250 major incidents, systematically collecting and analyzing evidence that has been used to identify terrorist perpetrators, their networks, and bring them to justice. Through their hard work and dedication, the joint investigative teams are changing the public's perception of the police. The joint investigative teams are poised to take on one of Somalia's most pressing problems, that is, effectively preventing terrorist attacks. This means that the next step, said Deputy Police Commissioner Mohammed, is to become increasingly proactive with a police force that is capable of detecting and disrupting plots before they are executed. The United States is proud to have had a hand in the formation of these police units, and we will continue to support their efforts to further build critical counterterrorism capabilities. We stand with the people and the government of Somalia in their commitment to defeating terrorism, ensuring the security of their people, and rebuilding their country. We look forward to continuing our cooperation on these and other issues.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.